From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Former President Donald Trump may have won the Iowa caucus decisively, but does that automatically guarantee him success in New Hampshire next week or even clinching the Republican nomination? History shows it's not necessarily a lock. That said, we've already seen the impact that Iowa has had on the presidential primary. Just hours after the final votes were cast, two Republican candidates dropped out, Vivek Ramaswamy and Asa Hutchinson, narrowing the field to three top candidates, Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, and Ron DeSantis. But why is the Iowa caucus so important in the presidential primary in 2024? With New Hampshire on deck, why do two small states with demographics that don't really represent the diversity of American voters have so much influence? Joining us today is Rob Stutzman. Rob is a Sacramento-based political strategist and a former deputy chief of staff for former governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Good afternoon.
Hi, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
You are actually in Iowa, so I'm sure you're basking in the warmer temperatures. How was it like, the caucus?
Well, the weather was an issue. I mean, it was cold. It was the coldest temperatures I've ever experienced. This delicate California boy was worried to getting out of there with 10 toes and 10 fingers. I made it. But weather was a factor. The other thing that was interesting was there's no Democrat caucus. The Democrats have changed the rules. So it was singularly a Republican-only caucus. And that changed the vibe a little bit. I've been there for the caucuses before. So it was Republican-only. And then who was going to win really wasn't in doubt. It was just a matter of what was Donald Trump's margin going to be. And the real prize was for second place between Haley and DeSantis, which is a bit of an insider nuance, right? So I don't know. I think this caucus unfortunately lacked a little bit of the drama and the interest that we've seen in the past.
Yeah. When it came to turnout, the turnout was low, right?
It was. It was just over 100,000. Usually they're more closer to 150. They had 185,000 in 2016, which was real competitive. There's no question the weather impacted that. Mm-hmm. We heard one story, a friend of mine, his parents are on a farm in northwest Iowa. They went to go out. They had to plow the road, their driveway to get to the road. The fuel in the tractor was beginning to gel, so they could not caucus. So the weather had some impact on the lower turnout, but I don't think it. I don't think how low it went was due truly to weather.
Okay. I mean, what do you think the other reasons are? I mean, do you think that there is voter apathy, or maybe like the appetite isn't there as it was in 2020 or 2016?
Yeah, there's apathy. So Trump did not win Iowa in 2016. He finished second to Ted Cruz. He only added about 20,000 more votes this time in his runaway landslide victory than he had his second place in 2016. So arguably, there's a little bit of a waning movement around Trump. On the other hand, he has formed the Republican Party in general to reflect him. And so that's where a majority of Republicans the other night were. They were with Trump, even if it wasn't all that enthusiastic. And then you have Nikki Haley, who really is appealing to moderate Republicans and non-Republicans. So in Iowa, where that was a closed system of just registered Republicans, there wasn't a ton of enthusiasm for her. And the numbers that she did get truly represent just that part of the party that wants to reject Donald Trump.
Hmm. Yeah, when you were just having conversations with Iowans, obviously, like, they are known for being, really pivotal and carrying a lot of weight, especially during presidential elections. What were they telling you? What did you kind of gather from them?
That it's a foregone conclusion for Trump. They really don't like Joe Biden. I think what we're starting to see, and this is under analyzed by the mainstream media, is that Joe Biden consolidates Republicans into Donald Trump. They may not want to vote for Donald Trump, but they are never voting for Joe Biden. I think we're starting to see some of that happen. So some college educated, Republicans are starting to come back into the Trump column. Then those that were adamantly against Trump were enthusiastic about Haley, but couldn't figure out how she's going to get there. And then DeSantis, I didn't talk to anyone, meet anyone that was enthusiastic for DeSantis. Now, obviously, he finished in second place, but he also invested in the most infrastructure to truly get people out to vote.
He went to like every county in the state.
He did the full Grassley is what they call that, named after Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Visit every county. He committed everything to Iowa. I mean, they spent $120 million thus far, and their path was to win Iowa, which has, you know, been taken from them some time ago. But the mechanisms of that still got him obviously into second place. But you didn't really have any palpable sense that there was a real movement for DeSantis.
So now the focus obviously is New Hampshire. That is next week. I mean, I think about both states. They are both small. Iowa's population is 3.2 million. Like Los Angeles County is three times that. It's nearly 10 million. New Hampshire's total population is 1.4 million. That is less than the county of Sacramento. According to the census, overwhelmingly white, 89% in Iowa, 92% in New Hampshire. Do these or should these states carry as much weight as they do in 2024?
So here's the thing. I think the case against those states you've cited, they're not diverse. They really don't reflect America. And if nothing else, maybe some other states should have this opportunity at times instead of it always being Iowa and New Hampshire. The case, though, for small states is it allows candidates to go in and build support without having to spend a lot of money. So, for instance, if California was first in the nation, your barrier to entry would be substantial. Only rich candidates or candidates that have a ton of money would be able to compete here. So if you look at the history of Iowa, it really became famous in 1976 when an unknown governor from Georgia named Jimmy Carter went and planted himself in Iowa and did the work and then won the caucus and, of course, rode that to a nomination and ultimately the presidency. Similarly, Barack Obama, running against the establishment favorite in Hillary Clinton, pulls off the stunning upset that changes that race and launches him eventually to the White House by doing that in Iowa. If it had started in Illinois or California or Texas, probably Hillary Clinton wins those because she would have been able to outspend him at that point.
Oh, yeah. And then I just think about hitting every county. There's 58 in California. I mean, it's a huge state. So when it comes to Trump's big win out of Iowa, I mean, that's what, 20 delegates? And then you need like over 1,200, you know, for the GOP nomination. I mean, how much weight? I mean, you are a political strategist. I mean, you have that historical context. We also know that you don't, if you win the Iowa caucus, it doesn't really mean it is a direct, it opens the door to the presidency. I mean, how much stock do you put into the caucus today?
I put a fair amount into it. I think it reflects generally where the Republican Party is, which is consolidating around Trump. The opportunity to change the race will be Tuesday in New Hampshire. New Hampshire, the rules are a bit different. Independents may vote. There's also, once again, not a Democrat New Hampshire primary, at least not one with delegates behind it, because the Biden camp has changed the rules for their process to start in South Carolina. So does that free up independents that may be voting otherwise in Democrat primaries this time to come over and vote in the Republican primary? That's what we'll wait and see. This is Nikki Haley's chance to make Donald Trump bleed and defeat him somewhere. If she doesn't do it Tuesday, they then move on to her home state of South Carolina, which is kind of a hybrid where it's not a caucus, it's an election, but independents can vote. But it's a much more conservative state, and she's behind in the polls there. So New Hampshire could play, and as they have in the past, this big role after Iowa of putting the race onto a different trajectory if she's able to win Tuesday.
I understand the case that you made when it comes to, you know, not having it be like California or Texas or a huge state, right? Because you would need a tremendous amount of capital behind you to do that. But what about like a purple state, like Nevada or something like that? Or I don't know, Florida.
Why? Well,
Nevada's smaller.
So to me, Florida's too big still, but I would... But Nevada is a great, there's an interesting case for Nevada. I mean, Nevada, though, you know, basically the population is in two metro areas in the north and south. But Nevada, I think, would be a great candidate. I think Arizona could be a candidate for this, which is also a purple state. You can make the case to do this in a purple state like Georgia. There's definitely other states that fit the bill. You could talk about going to South Carolina as just first in the nation, too, as the Democrats have done. I will defend the small state idea because I think there's real merit to it, and I think it equalizes the playing field. But I am for rotating this around. I think we should have some diversity in which states and which Americans get the opportunity to play this vital role. I mean, basically, DeSantis beats Haley by 2,000 votes, right? I mean, there's just 2,000 Iowans changed the whole dynamic of whether Haley was going to have any real momentum coming out of Iowa. Same if 2,000 fewer had not voted for Trump, you'd be under 50%. You'd have a different narrative. That's probably just a little too much political capital to put in the hands of the same people every 4 years.
Yeah. Speaking of reform, California is moving up to Super Tuesday. So in March, I mean, what kind of impact do you think this change for this election, what it could have?
Well, Californians get to play, Republicans get to play here, and it could be very relevant.
We're home to the largest delegates.
Absolutely. There's more Republicans in California, as blue as it is, than any other state. So there's a lot of important voices, Republican voices here that could play an important role. We had an early primary in 2008, and we're part of Super Tuesday, and John McCain won here, beat Mitt Romney, and really was a key part of propelling McCain to the nomination. So again, California could have that role. The important thing I always point out to people to remember is Super Tuesday may be March 5th, but ballots are going to be in people's homes that first week of February. And so the California primary really begins here in just a few weeks, which will be interesting because if Haley wins in New Hampshire and has some momentum, that maybe that could influence some of that early voting that takes place in California.
Given that, you know, we're home to the most Republicans, you know, despite, you know, being a blue state, you know, an Iowa Republican isn't the same as a Republican in another state. You know, we don't paint people with white brushstrokes. So how do you think candidates kind of tweak their campaigns, you know, as they go from Iowa to New Hampshire to South Carolina to Super Tuesday in a state like California?
Yeah, so look, in Iowa, it's a very evangelical state. That is still the base of the GOP. It's generally more blue collar than some other states, certainly than what California Republicans would be. So there is the opportunity to change your pitch and tone on some issues. So if you're coming to California, you probably are more likely to be talking about affordability, talking about homelessness, crime, and border security. And I think, you know, if you candidates get the opportunity to have to campaign in California, I think you'll see them talking about issues like that, which, you know, we're not quite as dominant as what they were talking about in Iowa. Mm.
Given that, you know, we're home to the most delegates, you know, why doesn't Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis, their teams, their campaigns, like really just go all in? I understand it's a big state, but it can move the needle.
Yeah, it's where it falls on the calendar. So Super Tuesday is where we are. So is Texas, and I think it's about 17 others or states total. So it becomes a big spread. It still comes back to dollars. You can travel up and down the state, and you're going to meet, you know, 100,000 people, which proportionally is nothing. But in Iowa, you meet 100,000 people, and that's how many people caucused the other night, right? And then the media market costs here are just extraordinary. It's like running a small country to have to campaign in California. It's just unfortunately very impractical.
There's also a lot of other key races, and a big change this year is former Speaker Kevin McCarthy is a former Speaker.
Right.
What impact do you think that's had on this election?
I don't think it has much on the election directly. I do think McCarthy was such an outstanding political leader and fundraiser that it may at some point limit some of the resources that Republicans will have in trying to defend their majority. I think they're going to miss him as a political leader. Having said that, I think when it comes to key races, especially here in California, I think, you know, candidates on both sides will be pretty well funded.
You know, we do have a race for a new senator. And mm-hmm. So there are three leading Democrats, Adam Schiff, Porter, as well as Barbara Lee. But there's also Garvey, who is a Republican, also a former baseball player. What kind of odds or stock do you give in potentially having a Republican be a California senator
well,
in 2024?
It's interesting. So, Steve, you have to be about my age, which, you know, it's mid-50s, to really remember Steve Garvey as a baseball player. But that's still something. There's still some residual fame attached to him and some name ID. And the media has really kind of taken up, you know, Garvey and reporting his name. So what that does is it gives the opportunity for him to signal to Republican voters, hey, over here I am, I'm your Republican. I'm the guy to vote for. And if he's able to consolidate Republican voters around him in the primary, I mean, he very well could get into the mid 20 percentile of the vote in March, which would put him into the runoff. Remember, in California, it's a top two runoff. So it's either going to be two Democrats or a Democrat and Garvey. And that'd be interesting. I think, you know, it's almost impossible for a Republican to win a race like that statewide. But Garvey would be a very different type of candidate. And I think could make things more interesting than they have been for the last decade or so for Republicans.
Aside from the name recognition, when it comes to public service policy, is there any meat on the bones?
Well, that's what we're waiting to see. He hasn't answered much about specific positions on issues. Now, strategically, I don't think he needs to. I think he just has to say, hey, I'm the Republican. But he has taken an extraordinary position thus far. I've been told by a reporter that was interviewed him yesterday that he refuses to commit to vote for Donald Trump. Which, if you think about it, he's running as a Republican for the United States Senate. That is an extraordinary position to take as a candidate, and I think a courageous one. And I think that one that indicates he's interested in trying to expand beyond Republican voters in November, should he be on the ballot.
Right, because he needs California voters, and there is a sizable number of voters. I think it rivals the Republican Party, who are no party preference.
Correct. They're about the same. Now, there's some ideological splits within that population of no party preference voters, but he'll need to win 2/3 of independents and about 23% of Democrats to have a chance to actually win the seat. And to do that, yeah, he can't be someone that supports Donald Trump.
Finally, before I let you go, there was supposed to be a debate tonight, you know, for Republican candidates as well as one on Sunday. Both have been canceled due to low participation. Do debates have value anymore?
I think they do. You know, there's a lot of poo-pooing about the Republican primary debates that have taken place because Donald Trump wasn't there. But for Republican voters, they were trying to figure out who they wanted as the alternative. I think those debates were important. And Nikki Haley arguably rode great performance in those debates to where she is now, which is to be the person that has a chance to beat Trump in New Hampshire and get into a one-on-one race with him. So, yeah, I think those debates are still important.
After the primary, do you think there's going to be a debate among the two nominees? I mean, obviously, President Biden is the incumbent.
I don't think either Biden or Trump really want to debate each other. But here's something to keep an eye on.
You think the public wants to see it?
I think they'd be horrified with what they might see. And so, disclosure, I'm working with a super PAC that would support a third candidate from New Labels, should they name that ticket. I, though, think that would be a fascinating debate. If no Labels ends up with a candidate, putting them on stage with Biden and Trump is something the American people want to see because they want to know if there's an alternative to what's being offered to them by the parties.
Rob, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Vicki.
Rob Stutzman is a Sacramento-based political strategist and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Up next, a Sacramento biotech company is using gene editing to try and create new cures for serious conditions like cancer. We'll learn about the technology's potentially life-changing implications. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. About a month ago, the FDA approved a first-of-its-kind therapy to treat people with sickle cell disease. The reason why this was such a big milestone is because it is the first treatment of its kind that uses gene editing. The technology is known as CRISPR, which modifies DNA, and it's really just the beginning. In Sacramento County, a biotechnology research center is diving into the world of stem cells and gene editing with the hope of speeding up advancements for new treatments and cures for patients diagnosed with cancer and other serious conditions, in some instances offering an alternative to chemotherapy or maybe even preventing a disease in the first place. Kate Spears is the CEO and founder of CGT Global. It's based in Folsom and joins us now to break down how this can lead to life-changing therapies. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
I would love to start with your background. How did you get involved in stem cells and gene editing?
So my background was actually, I used to be in healthcare and worked in an emergency room and thought I was going to be pre-med and an ER doctor at the time. I started working with transplant companies that were coming in to do transplantations. And I realized that most of the time, transplantation only really affects if you can get healthy tissue transplanted into someone else. But I saw all these patients dying from these diseases, and I knew that there were researchers out there that were struggling to get access to some of these tissues or blood samples from diseased patients. And so I initially kind of focused on that to try to help support research. You know, how can we partner with academic or private sector institutions and be able to get them the necessary access they need to these types of patients or just even diseased tissues that are going on in some of these surgeries?
So once that light bulb went off and then you obviously pivoted your career, as you continued to learn more, what are the biggest shortcomings that you discovered that you want to close?
Yeah, no, thank you. I think that one of the things that's fascinating about cell and gene therapies in general, and I think I get a lot of questions about this from the general public, trying to wrap their head around it. And I think the easiest way to maybe say this is that cell and gene therapies are essentially using those types of cell and gene therapies the same way we use drugs today or other treatments, but to actually treat someone's disease. And what's also amazing about that is that instead of people being on long-term medications, like in the pill form, some of these therapies actually cure diseases entirely, sort of irradiating the entire disease. That changes a couple major things that are coming out in our world today. So when you think about pharmaceutical companies, that sort of, you know, bread and butter for them is in pills that ultimately treat patients. And I would say almost 6 years ago or so after I'd started this company, which is we're coming into our 14th year, if you can believe it. But about 6 years ago, I noticed that these pharma companies started creating presidents of cell and gene therapies within their own pharmaceutical companies because they understood that the world was going to start pivoting in medicine to actually being able to treat and permanently cure these diseases. And so the shortfalls kind of land in two buckets that I see today and that I'm really passionate about making a change at. One, supporting these therapies through the FDA. That's sort of crucial step one. Once these therapies get approved through the FDA, and they're starting to happen, just like that recent announcement on sickle cell, then how do we scale them into healthcare? And this is a big topic to unpack because when you think about it, it's about patient access, it's about medical equality, it's about what hospitals in town can you even go to get access to these therapies. And if you're a patient nowadays with access to the internet, you're Googling about this, right? You're looking at this and you're going online and you're realizing that there's these therapies and you want access. You want your insurance provider to cover it. You want your health local hospital to offer it. And so where we're really focused, especially within the region, is how can we expand that footprint? How can we open up medical access and just, you know, make it more available?
You bring up a really important point because when it comes to this recent FDA approval, NPR followed a patient who went through this for 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't only costly, it's an arduous process as
Absolutely.
Well. And there is just, you know, it physically as well, and I can't even imagine emotionally, as well as your family and loved ones, but it was costly. I mean, the treatment cost like $2.2 million.
Yep, sure did.
So how do you and your colleagues and people who are in support of this work to make it accessible to the most vulnerable people who would need something like this?
Absolutely. So I think the first part I'll talk about is cost. So right now, the way this has been handled is there's a lot of companies involved in trying to get those therapies not only finished, approved, then manufactured, then how do we get them thawed back and retransfused into a patient? So there's a lot of steps in that circle. And I think what we're trying to focus on is like if we can tighten that circle and reduce how much time it's like flying from here to Maryland to a facility to be manufactured back here to this country or back here to this state, right? And then for the example you said, these patients have to travel in lots of circumstances. They're taking tons of time off. It's you know, a whole life change to the way they're managing their disease today. So in trying to regionalize that and say, if we're partnered with a company, a pharma company that can manufacture this locally, then how can we then turn around and say, we don't have to have, you know, somebody travel to Texas or Sloan Kettering or Dana-Farber. How can we regionalize that access? And that also helps reduce the cost tremendously. The next part I think you mentioned in this and thinking about patient access broadly is that if you know people, right, and if you have good access in healthcare, you know, you can, and you have money, you can travel to the most cutting edge facilities in the world and try to, you know, move yourself up on the list to get access. What I'm really passionate is that we should be able to have, my dad was born in Arkansas, my mom was born in Missouri, so I've got the Midwest roots, but is that when you should have the same access to therapy in both those states that you should in Manhattan and California. And in order to do that, we have really developed at our company a way to kind of mobilize this, like whether or not it's with vehicles, whether or not it's home health, touching base, creating GMP laboratories that we can put in a hospital parking lot, put in these locations where we can start to funnel that in. And where I'm really focused, Vicky, today is what I call like the last mile to patients, is these therapies are coming. I don't know if you got a chance to even see, but there's 3,200 pending FDA approval today, 3,200. And so when we look at these handful that are just approved, we have an entire tidal wave coming to us, which is fabulous if you're a patient dying of a disease today. But how are we going to access that? How are we going to create these kind of accesses and get the hospitals online to be able to do this? And so we're partnering essentially between that pharma and hospital client and helping to elevate that and really speed up, scale the process, keep the cost downs for hospitals, keep the cost downs for patients by trying to kind of create a regionalized access.
And you're positioned for this wave that is coming. You mentioned that you're going to be entering your 14th year. Mm-hmm. What happened between 2010 and 2024? What have you been doing for more than a decade?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, I would say that we have helped some of these therapies get approved by the FDA. We have worked with companies that are creating new blood tests. I say all the time, and I'm still shocked people don't realize this today, there's a blood test on the market that you can go have that will tell you if they find cancerous cells in your body. We helped three of those major companies actually develop those tests. So there's a lot available that I'm realizing more and more that our success, we used to always rank by, let's help them get through R&D, let's get through clinical trials, we'll help them get FDA approval, and then we would sort of celebrate. But honestly, on the backside, I would find that most people in the general public didn't even know these tests exist. Most of their healthcare partners didn't even have access to those tests to order. Mm-hmm. So that really pivoted me in the last few years to realize that we can't just celebrate the approval. We have to celebrate the execution of getting access to patients and getting it into the right hands and available at hospitals.
And obviously, you already have people who are going in and they're donating their blood or their bone marrow, cord blood. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through how the process works?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of you in the region, I mean, we have a clinic in Folsom where we accept like normal healthy donors, disease patients that are coming in, and we're, you know, have a whole program right now for seniors where we're really focused on collecting blood samples from seniors, and all part of different research studies and clinical trials that we're involved in that are supporting, honestly, globally. We ship products globally almost every day, but these are going to major academics in the country. They're going to private sector, device development companies, pharmaceutical companies to create these kind of access to different therapies. So yeah, our center, just for folks that are interested in that, you know, if you were to walk in today, you know, someone will talk to you and at least be able to say, hey, this is what you would qualify for if you want to participate and you want to be a part of that.
And so it's essentially you are helping in advancements in future treatments or even cures or even prevention in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we've learned from over the years of doing this, I mean, we've had people staffed at hospitals for years. So even here, for example, Sutter Health, we have somebody there 24 hours, 24/7, 365 days a year. And to your point, exactly like you said, they may be working within collecting umbilical cord blood on one part of the floor. They may be transferring down and collecting a cancerous tumor sample from a patient on a different floor. We're trying not only from our own external locations, but also with our partnerships with healthcare, how can we broaden what we're doing with them, allow them to have more access to this kind of not only research, but as those researchers, the research products get improved to actual clinical therapies, we can use that same infrastructure with staffing to then and do bedside and help the hospital be able to treat these patients so they're not having to do so much lifting on their side.
So if I understand this correctly, if this goes how you want it to go and it scales up the way you want it to scale up in, I don't know, years or decades from now, someone would go in and say if potentially they received a serious diagnosis, there could potentially be a treatment for them or a cure. They would give their own blood or bone marrow, and then there would be some editing of their DNA. It would be put back into them, and then hopefully that would at least reduce or cure that ailment.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think when you see gene editing and CRISPR technology, CRISPR is a client of ours as well, but when you see that sort of gene editing happening, there's so much possibility to say if you carry the gene for breast cancer and you have children, could we edit this gene and essentially not pass it forward? There's a ton of work going on with that. So preventative is a very big part of this. But exactly like what you said, if you just got a diagnosis and you have this disease, is there a therapy today where we can use your own cells out of your body, exactly like you said, edit them, put them back into your body and let those new cells, as I tend like to say, you know, especially with CAR T, you'll hear that term a lot, CAR T treatments for cancer. You know, it's like supersonic T cells. I tend to give the general public the idea of imagine if we took your cells and turned them into Navy SEALs and then put them back into your body and let them go after your cancer. Where does that go to, Vicky, when you start to think about like tumors and you start to think about chemotherapy and radiation? Right now we do all of these things. Again, it's to me, it's a shotgun blast to kill a gnat, right? It's we target patients in such a way to irradiate their systems to try to get after these cancers. When we can start taking targeted cells and put them in your body and say, now go target that tumor in your breast, I think it really changes the future of medicine. Because the question becomes, are we going to see chemotherapy go away in 5 to 10 years? Are we going to see even the removal of tumors go away, right? When we can start to use these cells in the way that they're so powerful and can help our own bodies.
Are there companies like yours in California or in the country? I mean, how many of there are you?
So yeah, no,
because you mentioned there's over 3,000 patents being filed right
yes,
now.
Yes, yeah, 3,200 actually pending FDA approval. So that means they've already gone through all their clinical trials and they're in different stages of now they've applied to the FDA and they're waiting to get approved. So tremendous effort to get to that point. So there are companies like ours that work in research that will just help, you know, kind of preclinical work in research. There's a few more that would help potentially with like clinical trials. Like sometimes you hear the term CDMOs or CROs, which might help with a clinical trial. In the space that we're talking about today, that last mile to patients, we don't have a competitor in that space. And it's really, I think, us taking years of expertise, like you said, in both those two previous buckets and saying, we know how to do this. We know how to isolate the cells. We know how to keep them stored at different temperatures and keep their viability and structure. Now let's add in that last piece to patients that hospitals are having such a hard time getting online. Right? Even within our own region, it's very hard. And people are traveling to Texas, they're traveling to Stanford, they're traveling all these places. So I love this region. You know, I graduated from Sac State. I was a Made It Sac State candidate and received a Distinguished Service Award from them, which I'm so honored for. But I'm really passionate about my own community. So how can we do this here? You know, you shouldn't have to travel to get access to this. And I think more so, you shouldn't need to be wealthy or be able to take tremendous times off work just to have your own life saved.
That was going to bring me to my next question. Why Folsom?
Yeah. Well, so I came up here actually to go to Sac State, and I did a quarter at UC Davis too as well, but came up here out of Santa Barbara to be here and really started calling this home. I will tell you that from a lot of the private equity and sort of business world, you know, you see a lot of companies leave our region, they go to San Francisco. I decided to stay, and I'm so happy that we did, because there was that push initially, like, do you just go to the Bay Area and, you know, raise money and do these kind of things? And so I really felt at home here, and I love our hospital partners in the region, and I'm so passionate for people to get access to care. So I stayed, and we've grown here. You know, we're now in multiple states as well. So we have a number of locations around the United States.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with CGT Global based in Folsom. And that is diving into the world of stem cells and gene editing with the hope of speeding up advancements for new treatments and cures for patients diagnosed with cancer and other serious conditions. So CRISPR, or the people who created CRISPR.
Jennifer Doudna, yeah.
Yes, from UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. Received the Nobel Prize not that long ago, like 2020. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, a relatively new field, I think, when it comes to medical research. But it also can make people a little uncomfortable, a little weary. It's been subject to scrutiny. When it comes to the potential cons of this, you know, we already talked about it being only for the privileged, but also being open to misuse or long-term unknowns. What protections need to be put in place?
Yeah, so, you know, we participate in a lot of different associations. There's one called ARM, and with the federal government. We also participate with the FDA and the NIH in looking at exactly what you said, sort of like ethical concerns and where do we not make those regulatory things so heavy that we actually drive the cost up, right? So there's a real balance there with thinking that with entities that have gotten through FDA approval, they've done that heavy lifting. They've showed sort of those components and the ethicalness and the safety to patients, right? But we also don't want to go crazy with regulation to where, again, that 2.2 million sickle cell treatment becomes 3.2 million next year, right? So we've got to be really cognizant on the cost. I think that one of the things that you're touching on that I see a lot of people say is, you know, if you carry the gene, for example, Vicky, to carry, you know, to have breast cancer and you are going to have children, you want to deal with this not only for yourself, for your future, but your children. I think people start to get really worried and say, well, what if it was to make you taller? What if it was to make your skin a different color? What if it was to make your eyes bluer? What if it was to create these sort of, you know, perfect situations? People get very concerned about that. And I think that's very valid. And the FDA has done a really good job. And I think societally wise, right, we've said, you know, what we're willing to look at or not. But I strongly believe that for some people out there, I completely respect their decision. If they're like, you know, I feel like, you know, I wouldn't want to have this done for me and my family. Completely respect that. But I also am of the position that we need to not limit it for other people then. Because, you know, these diseases, just to give one to you, for example, like Bayer has this very exciting one on Parkinson's. I just had a friend of mine's wife who passed away from Parkinson's. And if you've ever known anyone who's died of these diseases, it's traumatic. And the new therapy that's coming on the market for Bayer that just made it through phase two is moving into phase two trials with the FDA is actually injecting cells in neural tissue into the brain to actually be able to reverse the effects of Parkinson's. It's extremely exciting. I'm just over the moon to get to work with some of these people and these amazing scientists and medical doctors that are in this space. But I'm so focused on the logistics, right? Like, okay, now we get approval. Now what? Right? We can't just have this only available here. This needs to be a global presence that allows access to these.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, there's, of course, altruism, but there's also, in healthcare, there's a profit to be made as well. Yeah. It is a business. Do you foresee challenges when it comes to healthcare and coverage, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies? You know, by curing someone of a disease or a condition, you don't need medicine for it, right?
Yes, I think it changes the whole structure. I really do think it's a revolution for medicine that we're seeing here. And it's already started. You know, it's not like it's coming. It's here. It's fully here. The second part that to what you're saying is hospitals need to pivot in this space, right? So a lot of them have spent the last decade opening chemotherapy plants, right? Plants or treatment centers, right? And so I've talked to these hospital executives and said, what we need to start thinking about is how do we take 25% of that facility where you're giving chemo and give people back cells using the same infrastructure that you've put in, right? How do we start to make that curve in the road that's sort of coming? But the other part to what you're mentioning is really just down to numbers. I think that if Blue Shield, Blue Shield were to look at this and say, okay, average cancer patient from diagnosis, about 1.2 million. Okay, that includes removing a tumor, chemo, radiation, XYZ. If we can get the cost of a cell therapy down to like 800,000, it financially makes sense. Right. So I think this is why pricing is very, very key to access. We can't price it to the moon and then expect, you know, insurance companies to just start doling out access. It's not a reasonable approach. So we're very focused on that cost. And again, sort of through partnerships with our entities, we don't have to put this on them. And I'll share one thing, too, is that I was out at Dana-Farber's facility a handful of months ago. They spent $30 million, you know, building out what is an ability to manufacture their own CAR Ts in their own center. They are almost at max capacity. There's not enough rooms, patients, bookings, everything to make this work. So if I were to look at, you know, Sutter, Dignity, Kaiser in this region and other partners, you know, do they have $30 million sitting here today, right, to be able to build this up? The majority of hospitals, are their margins are like less than 2%. So they don't have the money to pivot like that. What my focus is saying, they don't have to build it. We can partner with them. We become that sort of connector between pharma and healthcare, and we become an outside clinic that is helping these partners doing their cell and gene therapy work in-house.
In the last 30 seconds or so we have, people may be learning about this for the first time or just realizing, you know, the magnitude of this, mm-hmm. you know, and what is here and what is to come. What would you like people to take away from this conversation?
So, I mean, on a real personal level, if this is something brand new to you, I really strongly suggest where you can, you know, go online and try to read about this. The CRISPR technology, Walter Isaacson just did a new book called Codebreakers. You can pick that up, I'm sure, at a lot of places and read about these type of gene editings going on. There's another great book, Cells Are the New Cure. But I would say if you are a patient today, please go and get online and research today what access you have, because you may be being treated by a physician who doesn't even realize today that there's one of these therapies that just got approved. And so we have to kind of own our own space here, too, with being advocates, not only for family members, but for ourselves and our children, around how do we sort of say, I want the best. I want the best option available to try to save my life or my family member's life.
Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Spears is the CEO and founder of CGT Global, based in Folsom, with a focus on stem cell and gene therapies. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Owning a home, it has long been part of the American dream, and for many, it is the largest financial decision of their lives. And it is increasingly out of reach. I don't have to tell you this. In recent years, first-time home buyers are facing high home values, coupled with high mortgage rates further weighed down by a continuous housing shortage. And that's already on top of the disparities in home ownership, which goes back decades. However, a new Sacramento nonprofit is giving these first-time purchasers a helping hand while also closing the gaps of owning a home and making it more inclusive and equitable. The nonprofit is called Sac Club 100, and the founder is real estate broker Keisha Key Matthews, and she joins us now with an update on her efforts. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So, just before we dive into the importance of your nonprofit, you have joined us over the years just about the real estate market, especially following the pandemic and these record low interest rates It's really done a 180. What does it look like right now in Sacramento and the surrounding counties?
Oh, it's looking like a bit of a strain, something we've never seen before. You really cannot predict anything at this point. Typically, when we have typical seasonal market changes that we could rely on, you know, during this time of the year, this is going to happen. All of that's out the window. There have just been, after COVID, there have just been so many variables that just change how we look at things and how we can perceive the market. It literally is a day-by-day, week-by-week type of environment.
When you started thinking about Sac Club 100, when did this idea first begin taking shape?
About a year and a half ago, I actually was thinking about my exit plan from the real estate industry. And in the process of doing that, I started thinking about the things that were left undone, things that I had hoped to help make a difference in that weren't being done. And what I mean by that, I like to say things that I have seen that I can't unsee anymore. The discrepancies and the disparities as far as how many minorities are owning home, how that number actually is going down. And especially during times like COVID, when the economy gets tougher, it's even harder on those that who've been historically disenfranchised. And then I'm also seeing, so not only is this impacting the historically disenfranchised, but just the everyday person who's going to work 5 days a week, 9 to 5, our so-called middle class, it is literally disappearing. And so we're seeing the homelessness numbers on the rise. And you can change the name of what you want to call it. It is still when a person no longer has a secure place of shelter over their head. They are now homeless. And we all either know someone or are close to being that someone. And someone has to step in and galvanize around an effort to make that different. And not just putting them in a renter position, but home ownership. You can no longer live in California and rent and be content. You cannot do that. If you don't own, that rent eventually is going to get away from you and you will no longer be able to afford to live in California.
Hmm. The nonprofit is called SAC Club 100. What does it stand for? What does it mean?
So it just means that we're starting here in Sacramento, starting right here in my little piece of the neck of the woods that I am able to, that I'm very familiar with. You know, we have relationships with, I have professional relationships with where we can actually make this happen. And 100 came from being the goal. I want to help 100 buyers into home ownership. And the goal was within 1 year, not knowing what was going to happen last year happened. But we were successfully able to get 24 families into home ownership last year. And so whenever you can accomplish something in the midst of a storm, that means when it settles, you can accomplish more. And so we're excited about 2024. We're excited about the nonprofit status because everything we did last year was without being under a nonprofit status. Being under a nonprofit status means that we're now able to apply for grants and financial assistance to actually help our buyers directly, where we don't have to go through loan programs. So that's an exciting piece.
When going through the home buying process, it can be incredibly intimidating. Mm-hmm. It could just be feel out of reach. You don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. How did you get those 24 home buyers across the finish line? What do you offer that's unique in terms of resources and support?
Absolutely. So I love this about us. And sometimes things that are for you can only be for you to do because of the experiences that you've had. And so being in a position where I am directly seeing the limitations that are stopping buyers, credit and being able to have the money for down payment assistance is huge in those who have been historically disenfranchised. Where the disconnect occurs is whenever those individuals attempt to seek home ownership opportunities, most lenders and loan programs and agents will not bend over backwards. They will not turn over what we call turn over every rock to see what alternatives or options are available to you. And that's where we differ. They don't do it because it takes more time. They don't do it because if you don't come buyer ready, then you need to go and get yourself ready. Whereas those folks are like, well, how do I get ready? And we say, we will help you get ready. We will help you map out the plan towards home ownership. And not only are we taking the time, but the individuals who are on this team, Team SAC Club 100, these are lenders and agents. We're at different brokerages, and we are high performing in our own respect. So we have systems and processes in place. We have a standard of excellence out the gate and a heart for service. And so over the past year, forming this team and what it looks like has been a job in and of itself to refine it to get to this group who is just an amazing group of people. Amazing.
Who are you looking for in terms of clients, or someone's hearing this and they just want to become part of it? And is there an application process? How does it work?
Yes, at joinclub100.com, joinclub100.com. If you go to the site, you'll see two tabs, one that says join the club, one that says join the lab. The join the club tab allows you to connect with us. We have a 20-minute buyer consult, or we call it a discovery call, where we talk to you about your needs, what's your biggest obstacle preventing you from getting coming into home ownership. And right there on the website, when we get that feedback from individuals, most people are very transparent. This is what's stopping me. You know, I've been in this situation. I'm going to file bankruptcy. I just am tired of living paycheck to paycheck or tired of renting. And so we get some really heartfelt stories just right from that aspect. But if you join the lab, the labs are every last Saturday of the month. And thanks to Highlands Community Charter Tech School, we get their space for free. We get a lot of sponsors that help provide lunch for free, Fidelity National Home Warranty. And in this lab, you take this six-hour course where we're helping you understand home ownership, budgeting, credit restoration. The Sacramento Financial Empowerment Center teaches that piece. And so we've got all of these people that want to help for free, take the bigger steps, turn over every rock, and get people into home ownership.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about, you know, it's a very cliche saying, it takes a village. Is there anything else like this where you used as a framework, or is this something you just really have built up on your own?
It's all been so very organic. I know that it's God. I know that it's my, and I don't mean to go spiritual on you, but I kind of do, because sometimes you just know your direction or your purpose. And many times the vehicle or the tool that's going to help people, there's nothing that looks like it. And when things change and when situations change, it calls for something that is different. And we have a lot of nonprofit organizations that exist right now for this sole purpose, but our numbers aren't changing. So that says that whatever they're doing is not working, and we need to put together something that's going to help. And I think that I know that SAC Club 100 is that answer, because we are boots on the ground versus a lot of organizations start from the top and then go down. We are the agents. We are the lenders. We know what it takes. And so taking that extra step, taking that extra time, and developing the relationships, and just being creating a safe place, no matter what your position, that's what we're here for.
Keisha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicki, for having me.
And that is Keisha Key Matthews, who is the founder of SAC Club 100. It is a nonprofit that helps first-time homebuyers. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.